It is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I don't think there's a single American in this country who thinks the federal government is working exactly the way it should. But reform should be done lawfully.
I'm encouraged that Governor Hobbs has acknowledged the Republican position that we want to raise teacher pay and that she's coming in our direction.
It was a very tense evening. There's no two ways about it. I mean, people on both sides of the aisle feel very passionately. This is a very divided time in American politics, and I think that was very reflective on what you saw on the House floor.
To a certain extent, you get what you pay for, and I am worried that we are going to be overrepresented by people who are independently wealthy or otherwise well-kept because we don't nurture an environment where regular working class people can have this job and continue to support their lives and their families.
I certainly am not interested in bailing out the Trump administration for dumb decisions they make, like cutting off funding and staff for one of the largest tourist attractions in the country.
And with me to talk about a congressional candidate giving her race another go, the back and forth of tariffs against the state's two biggest trading partners and more, are Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning.
And former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to both of you. So let's start with Marlene Galan Woods, who has decided to make another run in the first congressional district. This is the David Schweiker district. Roy, I want to start with you on this. She did not make it out of the Democratic primary last year. What do you make of the fact that she's giving it another shot in a year from now?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, she finished third out of six in that primary last year. I don't know if it's going to be any different for her this time around. I don't know if anything is going to be different. But I think what it signifies, her getting in along with other folks already getting in that race, and then I think we're hearing that maybe Amit Shah, who's the Democratic nominee, is going to get in sometime soon. What I think that shows, again, is that that district is a heavily targeted district. You know, that one and, of course, the CD6 down in Tucson that's currently held by Juan Ciscomani.
Yeah.
I mean, these are two congressional districts that are going to decide, I think, who controls Congress, you know, after next year. It's a very narrow Republican majority in D.C. And conventional wisdom, you know, I think says that in this upcoming midterm, it is likely that Democrats take control of the House because usually there's always sort of the backlash to the existing administration, in this case, the Republicans being in charge of the White House. So, you know, again, I think Democrats are feeling, I think, pretty optimistic that in 2 years it will be a Democratic House.
Lorna, we've been hearing sort of about the, to paraphrase Mark Twain, the political obituary for David Schweikert for many election cycles now, and he's still there. He still keeps winning. And there was some conventional wisdom last year that maybe Galan Woods would be the strongest candidate from the Democratic side to go up against him. Mm-hmm. But of course, she didn't win in the primary.
Yeah, that's always difficult when you have such a contested primary, Republican or Democrat, a five-way, six-way like that one is. Anybody can pull off the win, right? And so, yes, she came in third. She's now announced. I think from a strategy standpoint, it makes sense because anybody who announces this early for a race that's next year, they just want to start fundraising, mm-hmm. right, and get the name out there and hopefully keep other people from jumping in. But I don't think that's going to be the case in this scenario. As Roy mentioned, there's other people who are already saying that they're going to, you know, formally announce in the summer, like Amit Shah, some others. So it's going to be another contested primary. That is a very interesting district because on paper, it should be a lot more competitive than it has been, right? And as you mentioned, people have been talking about the downfall of David Schweiker for many years, and he's been successful. And he's one of the few Republicans, I feel like somebody really needs to analyze this, that's been able to thread the needle on the Trump dynamic really well.
Hmm.
You know, he's not anti-Trump, but he's not outspoken in favor of a lot of the policies. And right now, David Schweiker is actually in a very good position with his number one policy priority has been the federal budget, federal deficit, cutting spending, right? That's Trump's priority right now. So this is something that David Schweiker really can be a leader on because he's been, you know, sounding the alarm for so long about the bad financial situation the country is in. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see, but it wouldn't surprise me if Schweiker pulls it off once again.
Are there any, I mean, we've seen this a lot, both in Arizona and elsewhere, that people who run for, especially for Congress, don't win, come back 2 years and try running again. And sometimes they win and sometimes they don't. Is it Is there anything that we can draw from rematches in congressional races, or is it so candidate, maybe district, and maybe cycle specific?
There's just so many outside factors. It really is candidate specific and then cycle specific. Who knows? I mean, we were just talking about before, every day there's a different, you know, news item coming out of Washington, D.C. with what the Trump administration's doing. So what we're talking about now may not even impact, you know, the election in November 2026, right? So there's that. And then there's also a lot of people want to build on the momentum of the previous cycle, right? You've invested a lot of time and energy in building your name ID. Sometimes people think, if I jump in again, I can just continue that momentum. But sometimes you building up your name ID actually turned voters away from you, and they don't actually want to see your name on the ballot again, right? So it really does depend on the candidate. And I'm not going to mention who we've witnessed in the past where that's happened. But so it is a crapshoot, right? But we're so far away, so many other dynamics are going to impact that race.
Well, so Roy, from a Democratic perspective, given that Schweikert has been seen as vulnerable for many cycles and continues to win, are Democrats looking forward to a potential rematch, be it Shah or Galán Woods, or is this maybe a time for fresh blood in that district?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, even as a Democrat, I have to acknowledge that Schweikert is a good campaigner. I mean, obviously, the results show that. He has had a target on his back for continuously for a number of cycles, yeah. And he keeps winning. To Lorna's point, though, I mean, he has led, and his main focus has been on the budget and potentially cutting the deficit and all that stuff. Going into next year, we might actually see, you know, the rubber hitting the road there, where we're actually starting to see some cuts from this administration, or at least a lot of proposed cuts from this administration. And I suspect that a lot of these cuts are actually going to be unpopular, that at the end of the day, people don't want some of these things to be cut. And he, meaning David Schweikert, is going to have to answer for that, right? And then that's going to be, I think, a main source of debate, I think, next year on sort of how smart these cuts have been. As far as name ID goes, I mean, it's a little bit hard here. I mean, Galán Woods, again, she didn't make it out of the primary, so I don't think there's really a whole lot to build off of from last time around because she wasn't the general election nominee. Sometimes the general election nominee, you know, does have some advantages if they're running again because there is, you know, sort of a built-out name ID. You have a fundraising, you know, sort of system.
They were a candidate for longer, if nothing else, right?
Exactly, yeah. So you do have some advantages there. But, of course, you still have to be a good candidate, right? Yeah. And so I think ultimately that's what we'll sort of have to see here if it is going to be, let's say, Shah again. But it also could be somebody new. And you know, to Lorna's point, it is a fascinating district, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about the wealthiest, most educated district in the state, right in the center of Phoenix, the heart of a lot of the business community, for example. So it will be very interesting to see if the Democrats have somebody else that could potentially be a good candidate in the general election.
So Lorna, Roy was talking about some of the cuts coming from the federal government. Some of them affect the National Park Service, and we have seen longer lines of people trying to get in to the Grand Canyon. Spring break coming up for a lot of folks next week. There's some issues with the water pipeline that provides water to the South Rim. Governor Hobbs this week said, look, if this is the problem, the feds need to fix it. We're not going to spend our money, the state money, to fix this. I'm curious what you make of that, especially given that in the past, for example, during government shutdowns, the state has spent money to open it up with the expectation usually that we'll get reimbursed afterwards.
Yeah, you know, I'm not surprised by Governor Hobbs's decision because the Grand Canyon is not shut down, right? So in the past, when Governor Brewer or Governor Symington, you know, used state resources to reopen the Grand Canyon, that was important because you can't have such an important asset like the Grand Canyon shut down economically in the state of Arizona. It's still open. Is the situation ideal? No. So I understand the fact that she does not want to put resources toward it, not knowing if the Trump administration is going to reimburse, and then also not knowing what's going to come down the pipeline and impact the state of Arizona when it comes to federal, you know, cuts. She has to prepare for that as well, where that money might need to be spent in the future, depending on what the federal government decides to cut that's going to impact Arizona. So not surprising to me. But again, the Grand Canyon is such an incredible resource. I think it should be operating at full speed. But again, it's not shut down like it was in the past. So it's not surprising she's not putting the resources behind it.
Well, Roy, I guess there's also, given what's going on with Congress, there's no guarantee there won't be a shutdown coming up in the not-too-distant future, right? In which case, the governor will maybe have to make a slightly different calculation.
Right. I mean, and that's part of the problem here. I mean, you've got sort of one set of questions about whether we're going to have, you know, a continuing resolution or a new budget agreement in D.C., or are we going to have a government shutdown? And then there's also kind of the separate question of like these sort of unilateral cuts that Trump has been doing, right? Through whether it be through DOGE and Elon Musk or, you know, the kind of recommendations that he's proposing. And so, you know, if you're the governor, for example, and you're dealing with your own budget limitations, right, you have to sort of prepare for the fact that we could have what I would sort of call a normal government shutdown. I mean, hopefully that wouldn't happen. But then also this idea that, you know, some program might just be cut tomorrow because that's what Elon Musk wants, right? And so, you know, preparing yourself for that, I think, is much more difficult and complicated than, you know, maybe it had been before. And so I agree with her in this instance. We have to keep the Grand Canyon open, but we are not in a position where we even know, you know, how it would be cut. And, you know, I think until we know that, the governor is doing the right thing.
I think it says a lot about where we are as a country that there is such a thing as a normal government shutdown right. at this point, don't right. you think? I mean, that's really something. I mean, Lorna, very quickly before we go to break, is there, like, are there political ramifications? I mean, it's obvious, like, if you can say, I kept the Grand Canyon open, that seems like a political win. Mm-hmm. Is this maybe a little more nuanced for the governor?
Yeah, it is. And I don't think it's getting as much attention as when the Grand Canyon has been shut down in the past, right? Yeah. So I don't think she's going to be facing the criticism as, you know, if it was shut down and she was deciding, okay, well, that's on the federal government. We're not using Arizona resources to keep the Grand Canyon open. So I just think this is one of many things that the governor is dealing with and is going to deal with that is just ramifications of federal government decisions in the Trump administration. But I don't think she's going to get much backlash over this one.
Roy, let me start with you on the back and forth of tariffs with Arizona's two biggest trading partners, Mexico and Canada. President Trump announced 25% tariffs this week. Seems like a lot longer ago than that, but it was just a few days ago. And then more recently, he said, we're going to pause on some products, and then we're going to pause on stuff that's covered by the USMCA, the new version of NAFTA that he helped negotiate during his first term. What does this do politically for Arizona to have this sort of constant back and forth with two other governments and groups of people that we spend a lot of money on and get a lot of money from?
Well, I mean, it's not good. Leaving aside the politics for a minute, I mean, it's not good for the economy, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we've already starting to see some of this reaction in the stock market and, you know, some of the sort of growth indicators indicate that we're going to have a bad economic quarter this year. And so it's already, the effects are sort of already there because of the uncertainty. I mean, you know, just going through this timeline in a week, you know, we've had, you know, two versions of tariffs and then we've had them rescinded and I imagine there's going to be another, you know, month or so, another threat of, you know, additional tariffs, so on and so forth. And we all know, again, that, you know, tariffs, and every economist, I think, will tell you that tariffs are bad, I mean, for the economy, because it will result in, you know, increased costs, right? I mean, these costs are going to get passed down to consumers. And, you know, in a world where I think very loudly last election, people in Arizona spoke and said, we don't like the high cost of things, this isn't going to make it any better. And so if that is the case, if we continue to go through this chaos and this back and forth and we do see prices go up, then I think politically it is going to be pretty damaging to Trump.
Lorna, the one thing we always hear about business is that they hate uncertainty.
Mm-hmm,
it seems like this is like nothing but uncertainty.
You're exactly right. And that was my point that I was going to make is that, you know, as the business community, and especially if you're like a, you know, a global company, you're looking for certainty, right? So if you're going to put tariffs on, okay, they're not going to like that, obviously, because it's going to increase costs. But at least they know what, you know, how things are going to operate, right? And so when you're preparing for something and then it gets pulled back and then it's going to happen in a threat, I mean, it just creates too much uncertainty for the business community and then the end payer for us, right? And then you're also looking at these fluctuations between the relationships with our neighboring countries, our largest trading partners, right? Some of our allies. And it's just unfortunate that is being used as a leverage tool when it impacts so many people in all three countries, right? Companies, consumers, et cetera. And so who knows? We might wake up tomorrow and there are tariffs again. But it just seems like it's a very odd negotiation tactic by the Trump administration.
Roy, let's move back to the Arizona legislature where we saw the resignation of a Democratic senator, Eva Birch of Mesa. This sort of follows from the last couple of years where lots of Democratic members resigned, in many cases saying that they just didn't think they could get anything done. They didn't enjoy being in the minority. It seemed like a waste of their time. And that was one of the things that Senator Birch mentioned in her announcement of that she was stepping down next a week from today. She also talked about legislative pay and that it was hard to make ends meet doing this job and raising a family. I'm curious what you make of this, especially because the pay was the same when she ran for re-election last year. It hasn't changed.
But I'm sure it was a struggle last year as well for her, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I hear as someone that talks to legislators all the time, I hear over and over again from them how much they hate their jobs, right?
I mean, you know, and yet they keep running for them.
They do, right? But I think there's a couple of things going on here. I mean, one is just sort of the nature of politics, I think, are worse and worse as time goes on, both the kind of criticism that you get from the public and just, you know, generally what relationships are like down there. And so that makes it hard. I think, you know, the fact that sessions keep going longer and longer, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we don't have sort of these quick budget agreements anymore.
It's not 100 days, for
right.
sure.
It'll be, you know, well into the summer, so you're working a lot. I mean, this, you know, if you take the job seriously, it is a lot of work, right, to learn about legislation and policy and things like that, all coming to, you know, the fact that you don't have a lot of pay, right? I mean, it's very little. I mean, my personal view has been that we should raise, you know, pay for legislators, I think. Not only is it more commiserate to like the kind of work that they're putting in, but then I think we'd also get better legislators. We'd get people that, you know, could give up careers potentially mm-hmm. that are highly successful people that would go into the legislature. And that I think would raise, I think, the bar on the kinds of things we get done down there. Of course, that's just me speaking. I don't know if we'll ever, you know, I don't know if there's people that agree with me or not, but I think
I agree
that's the reality.
With you,
okay, great. But that is the reality down there.
Yeah. So, Lerna, of course, we don't want to ascribe motives to anybody. We don't know what's going on in anybody else's head. I wonder, though, if this is maybe a clue, the timing of this, that maybe Senator Birch thought she wouldn't be in the minority this year in the state Senate.
I mean, that's a fair point. I think a lot of Democrats were really optimistic that they were going to be able to take over at least one or if not both chambers last session. But I appreciate her candor in her resignation letter. That's something that you rarely see. I mean, we saw a lot of resignations last year from the Democratic Party, but they were like, oh, I got this great opportunity, or I'm going to do this. You know, they were going to the private sector and whatnot. But it is a real struggle, right, that the lack of pay, and we don't have a part-time legislature. In theory, that's what it's supposed to be, but it's not. And so anybody who's expected to make a living off of $21,000 a year and it pulls time away from you from your other job that actually is going to pay your bills, mm-hmm. takes time away from your family, I completely understand the dilemma she was facing. I know some people are like, oh, she must have known this going into it. You know, probably. But I think the offset is being able to accomplish something, right? And as Roy mentioned, the dynamics down there are a lot different than it used to be. There was a lot more bipartisanship 10, 15 years ago where Democrats could work with Republicans on some major policy reforms. You're not seeing that as much anymore. And so it's just something that we're going to continue to see. And as Roy mentioned, it makes it difficult to recruit people to run for the legislature because it's a time suck and you don't get paid very much.
It's interesting, though, because I've also heard the argument, Roy, that I've certainly heard the argument that you're making, and it sounds like Senator Birch is making, in terms of if you raise legislator pay, you'll get better candidates. I've also heard the argument that based on the way districts are drawn and the powers of incumbency, if you raise salaries, you're just going to pay the current legislators more.
Yeah, I mean, that gets into a whole other, you know, redistricting and sort of,
sure.
you know, what kind of legislature do we want down there? I mean, do we want, you know, for example, there's always the argument if the district is more competitive, you're probably going to get a better legislator, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody that's more interested in bipartisanship and things like that. I think that tends to be true, too. So, you know, that's a kind of a different dynamic. But that being said, I mean, you can always lose a primary, right? I mean, that's always possible, even in safe districts. And so, again, I think if you raise the pay to a level where, you know, somebody who, again, maybe has a successful business or a successful, you know, life career says to themselves, well, you know what, I do want to contribute and I can make it work by running for the legislature. And that's a good thing because I think there's a lot of people, I mean, we know a lot of people like this where I think they would be good at the job, but they're never going to do it because they simply can't afford it. They can't give up the other things that they're having to do. And so if we change that, then maybe we'd get better people.
Lerna, this has been on the ballot, the idea of raising legislative pay many times,
yes.
and it usually kind of goes down in flames.
Oh,
like, it's not a popular thing.
No, it's not.
Do you think that, like, these public resignations and comments by lawmakers leaving the legislature and specifically citing pay, does that move the needle for the public at all, do you think?
I mean, oh, I don't think it's going to move the needle. I mean, if this was on the ballot next cycle, I'd still think it would go down in flames. But I think it needs to be discussed, right? I think when the average voter sees it on the ballot, they're not aware of the dynamics down at the legislature, right? They just see, why would I pay these government officials that I don't think are doing a good job? Because, I mean, let's be honest, Republicans and Democrats are cranky about, you know, all levels of government elected officials. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, they're not going to want to give them a pay raise when they're struggling economically themselves and financially. So I think it's going to take a lot more education and convincing, and it'll take a very long time before voters all of a sudden feel like legislators should get paid more.
All right. So, Roy, we've got about a minute left or so. I want to ask you about a federal judge ruling, or a state judge this week ruled the state's 15-week abortion ban is unconstitutional. This had been challenged, of course, after the constitutional right to abortion was approved by voters in November. Do you see this as more of a symbolic victory, or is this a real? Does this have real practical impact as well?
I mean, it's a real victory in that now that law is no longer on the books, right? And it's a symbol, I think, of what this has meant now, the fact that we've passed this ballot measure, the fact that now a right to an abortion is enshrined in the state constitution, where we're never going to see these kinds of laws again, right? I mean, they're not going to be found constitutional. And we've seen down at the legislature, there's already some, you know, efforts by some Republicans to try to pass legislation that would limit abortions in various different ways. Now, those bills aren't going to go anywhere because the governor's not going to sign them. Mm-hmm. But even if they were to get through, you'd still have a lawsuit, right? There'd still be an argument that, you know, this would conflict with what's in the state constitution now. And so this decision by Judge Moskowitz, I believe, was the right one. I mean, it's clearly, you know, unconstitutional, or excuse me, it's clearly illegal to have a 15-week ban because of the constitution now. And any lawsuits going forward, I think, are going to have similar results.
Lorna, very briefly, the efforts that Roy alluded to at the legislature to continue to put restrictions on abortions, is this more of a base issue then for those Republican lawmakers doing it?
Oh, 100%. It's a base issue. It's something that you can put on a mail piece. It's just it's a political tactic, right? But one thing that, you know, Roy mentioned is obviously if they were to pass and go to the governor, she's going to veto it. You know, that's not going to stop somebody from running the bill in the eventuality that we get a Republican governor in the future. Mm-hmm. And then they sign it and then it triggers the lawsuit, right?
Yeah.
So it's just because it's enshrined in the state constitution doesn't mean it's going to stop anybody from running legislation.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Lorna Romero-Ferguson, Roy Herrera, thanks you both for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.